Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anjou. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as a person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And as normal, we begin our weekly reading of the Triangle Business Journal with the biz page. And under the heading of throwback comes the article, "Sorry, Charleston, now Raleigh has a yacht club too." Downtown Raleigh is packed with new and trendy bars, but a new one has just opened with a cheeky name and a desire to be a bit of a throwback. The Johnson Street Yacht Club debuted October 27th on, of course, Johnson Street, and just a few blocks off the main strip of Glenwood South. Manager Baron Hulk was stringing up lights a couple of days later on the patio and saying the bar, the former site of the Office Tavern, was looking to be a classic dive bar. "The idea is to be comfortable for everybody," he says. "The bar includes beer, shots, pool, and no food." Asked about the name and the fact that the ocean is more than 2 hours away, Hawk notes that the owners wanted a nautical theme. Good luck and bon voyage. And under the heading of patent leaders comes the article, These inventors are remarkably productive. When doing some research on patent assignees in the Triangle, Biz found a sweet dollop of data. According to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, there are three local inventors who have amassed more than 245 patents each. They are Howard Locker with IBM and Lenovo with 272, John Gansey Jr. with IBM with 256, and Jerry Negley with Cree and LED lighting fixtures with 245. The USPTO indicated Durham had the highest concentration of most prolific inventors in the Triangle. There were three that had more than 200 patents to their names. All of these inventors worked in the technology space, but one ventured on a new path. After his Cree and LLF days, Negley began oyster farming. Oh, and in case you're wondering, Thomas Edison had 1,093 U.S. patents. And under the heading of Long Reach comes the article, "California Fires Impact Carries Epic Games." The California blackout has hit the Epic team in Marin County, but that won't stop us. We'll go back to writing code the way our ancestors did, with quill pens. P.S. Does anybody know how to catch a bird? And under the heading of "More Decades Ahead" comes the article, "PNC Arena Celebrates a Two-Decade Run." PNC Arena has reached a milestone. The arena opened October 29th of 1999 as the Entertainment and Sports Arena and then became RBC Center before adopting its current name. The arena has hosted Paul McCartney and Elton John, in addition to the Carolina Hurricanes and NC State University's men's basketball team. The venue has hosted more than 2,900 events and 28 million guests. Significantly this year, the Centennial Authority paid off the original debt and assured the venue's future with funding from the region's tax on hotel nights and prepared food. All that will mean significant upgrades for PNC, led by improved fan areas on the side toward Carter Finley Stadium. And under the heading of "New Role" comes the article, "Holden Thorpe Joins the World of Journalism." Holden Thorpe, the former chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill, isn't someone you'd expect to land in the world of journalism. But on October 28th, Thorpe started a new job as editor-in-chief of the Science family of magazines. Thorpe spent the last 6 years as provost at Washington University in St. Louis after leaving UNC during a widening academic scandal. Thorpe rose up the ranks at UNC as a brilliant scholar, but was overwhelmed by the magnitude of a scandal. Of what he learned in Chapel Hill, Thorpe told Science Magazine, I learned a lot from that. The biggest thing being that when you're in a challenging situation, the goal is to get information out as quickly as possible. And any kind of controversial situation that we get into as science, I'm going to be disclosing things as quickly as possible. And finally, on this week's Biz page, under the heading of Targeting Growth, comes the article, Wake County Hunt for Jobs is Robust, but HQ's Still Elusive. The size of the pipeline is large when it comes to potential job recruitment for Wake County. In fact, says Michael Haley, Executive Director of Wake County Economic Development, the county is trying to lure 47 prospects and 15,000 jobs. Haley, speaking at a Triangle Business Journal event on October 29th on Fueling Tomorrow's Workforce, notes the companies eyeing Wake County are evenly split across technology, life sciences, and advanced manufacturing, a point that underscores the diversity of our regional local economy. But the region lacks many major corporate headquarters, and reeling in a Fortune 500 company is a big priority. Wake County scored a big win last year when Advance Auto Parts announced it was moving its headquarters from Raleigh from Virginia. Haley says the effort continues, and that much of the strategy involves branding, such as a national media campaign that recently had the Triangle making headlines in Toronto. It's not just, hey, come open up a business here, he says. It's stories like Dick's Park. They talk about Dick's Park in the same breath as they talk about these huge parks being developed in Toronto. While Triangle wins on talent, there are parts of the story that could be improved, he says, particularly a lack of transit. Meanwhile, Haley declines to specify whether the pipeline contains a Fortune 500 company eyeing the Triangle. There are companies of various sizes on that list, he says. Next, we turn to the technology and banking page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of Lawsuit, we find Epic Games sues video game tester. Carrie's Epic Games is suing a former game tester, claiming he broke his contractual obligation to keep Epic secrets about Fortnite. In a 27-page suit filed in federal court October 25th, Epic Games accused Ronald Sykes, also known as @Snippa, King2K, and FNGZoos, of spoiling secrets about Fortnite's upcoming season on Twitter. Sykes cashed in on what he learned as a user experience tester for Epic, the suit reads. He did so at the expense of Epic and those in the Fortnite community who were anxiously awaiting the new season of Fortnite, only have spoiled some of Epic's planned surprises, spoiled by Sykes' leaks. Sykes, who had participated in game testing in September, allegedly teased the new season on Twitter, even publishing an image of what was then a yet-to-be-disclosed Season 11 map. And Epic claims the leaks ruined the anticipation it was trying to build. In addition to injunctive relief, the company is asking to recover damages. According to Epic, anticipation in the Fortnite community about what would happen next was at an all-time high at the end of Fortnite's 10th season. And Epic teased changes to build suspense, tweeting, "The end is near," on October 11. When the countdown clock ended October 13th, a black hole replaced the game for about 40 hours before the new season was unveiled. Epic Games, represented by Christopher Thomas of Parker Poe, declined to comment on the suit. And under the heading of Coming is the article, How a Public Company Split Gives the Triangle New Headquarters. Fortive Corporation, based in Washington State, is splitting into two companies, and one could be headquartered in the Triangle. That's according to comments made by CEO James Lyko on an earnings call October 24th. Lyko told analysts that the firm will be putting the headquarters of New Company, that's N-E-W-C-O, in Raleigh-Durham. "We've got a location. We feel good about where we're at," he said. The company already disclosed plans to split into two new firms. One, called Fortive, remains in Washington. A second entity, NewCo, will be centered on rapidly evolving transportation and mobility markets and could be headquartered here. And under the heading of Red Hat, the article is entitled Denies Wrongdoing. Red Hat is denying wrongdoing related to a second set of sex discrimination allegations lobbed by a former employee. Danielle Malachek is one of at least two former Red Hatters to file similar complaints in recent months, and Red Hat has flatly denied wrongdoing in court filings for both cases, including an answer filed October 25th. Malachek, formerly of Durham-based Ansible, part of Red Hat's umbrella, sued Red Hat in June, claiming negative treatment because of her gender, including the reassignment of lucrative client accounts to male counterparts. The treatment sometimes materialized in the form of negative feedback based upon sexist stereotypes and prejudices, her initial lawsuit claimed. In a 20-page answer filed in the Middle District of North Carolina on October 25th, Red Hat, now owned by IBM, flatly denies wrongdoing in her case. Red Hat claims it divided sales territories due to high sales volume company-wide and not in retaliation for Malachek's complaints. Red Hat specifically denies that Malachek was subjected to any discriminatory or retaliatory conduct, the answer reads. While admitting Malachek was terminated after she filed a discrimination charge with the Equal Opportunity Commission, Red Hat denies any causal connection between that filing and her firing. In its answer, filed on behalf of Red Hat by Randall Avram of Kilpatrick, Townsend, and Stockton, LLP, Red Hat asked the court to dismiss the case. Avram didn't return a request to comment on the case. Red Hat declined to comment. Malachek is being represented by Michael Kornbluth of Kornbluth Ginsburg Law Group, who didn't return a request to comment. And continuing with the technology and banking page for this week's Triangle Business Journal, under the heading of Market Watch, comes the article, Raleigh's Capital Bank Branches to Become First Horizon Bank. There's a new bank in town, sort of. As of October 28th, Capital Bank locations in Raleigh have been rebranded to their new name, First Horizon Bank. The name change brings together all of the entities of First Horizon National Corporation, from First Tennessee Bank to Capital Bank, under one brand. It's an exciting day, says Laura Bunn, Triangle Area President. We've been working on this for some time. Right now, very little has changed. The signs still bear the Capital Bank brand. That's soon changing. But the changes is already showing up in a search for Capital Bank branches using Google Maps. Signage installation is being rolled out over time, she says. Our signs in the triangle will be completed or will be changed, most likely, by the end of February. Today, we're just making sure everybody has all the information and that customers are in the loop and understand this was a brand change, not a company change, Bunn says. This is a transformation. We're in an environment where change is inevitable, and we've got to adapt to that pace of change. So bringing our company under one brand will help us grow in key markets. And Raleigh, where the bank began with the acquisition of Trust Atlantic Bank 4 years ago, is one of those key markets, she says. 2018 was about bringing capital into the fold, converting systems, and making sure clients had a good experience throughout the transition. And 2019? Growth mode, Bunn says. On an earnings call earlier this month, executives said restructuring and rebranding would help the bank realize $65 million in net savings. And the new brand will be a prominent one in Raleigh, as a year ago, the bank announced plans to move its local headquarters to a 10-story tower downtown. And finally, under the heading of At a Glance, comes the article, Live Oak Greets Touts Great Confidence in Loans. Calling the firm's recently announced quarter its best ever, Wilmington-based Live Oak Bank Shares CEO Chip Mahan offered a peek at what he called Live Oak's credit quality sausage factory. With 45 recent college graduates and Live Oak's business advisory group picking up financial statements every 90 days from all 4,500 customers. Every quarter, there is a watch list meeting on every loan in the bank, he said. So that gives me great confidence that our portfolio overall is risk rated really well and can react real quickly, added Steve Smits, chief credit officer. Now we turn to the real estate page for this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of On the Move, we find the article, New Raleigh Hotel Announces Leadership Team. The owner of a highly anticipated hotel in Raleigh has announced as new general manager and hospitality director as the property prepares to open at the end of the year. Loudon Properties has named Tim Rogers the new general manager, and Matt Fern is hospitality director at the incoming Longleaf Hotel. Rogers brings 16 years of hospitality experience to his new role, having held sales and management positions at Marriott and Starwood properties throughout the South. Fern will handle the hotel's food and beverage offerings, as well as Delicatessen, which will be opening on the site in the future. Ish, the name of the delicatessen, will offer Jewish, Italian, and Southern options. The Longleaf Hotel will be an exciting addition to the downtown Raleigh neighborhood, says Russ Jones, partner at Loudon Properties. We've assembled a team with strong ties to the community who will be able to execute the highest quality service and engaging programming for hotel guests and locals. In 2018, the company acquired the former Days Inn at 300 North Dawson Street and a neighboring parcel for $6.5 million, with plans to convert the half-century-old building into a 57-room hotel. The project team includes Moorer Architecture, Land Planner Site Collaborative, Interior Designer Josh Kajosnik, General Contractor the Northgate Group, and Hotel Management by the Davidson & Jones Hotel Corporation. Loudon Properties bought the Days Inn from Yogi of Raleigh Incorporated, a company run by Arvind Shaw. And under the heading of What's Next comes the article, Nexus Project Includes Four Towers. More details have emerged about a four-tower, 1.15 million square foot project at the site of the former News and Observer property in downtown Raleigh. Dubbed the Nexus, site plans for the project filed earlier this year outlined the first phase of the project, calling for a 20-story, 325,000-square-foot office tower facing Salisbury Street with ground-floor retail. Last month, developers filed additional plans showing the full site and all four towers in greater detail, with the renderings depicting three 20-story towers and one 19-story office high-rise at the corner of Salisbury and Hargett Streets. Developers hope to begin construction early next year. Meanwhile, marketing materials for the project list a 250-room hotel, 45,000 square feet of street-level retail, and around 400 residential units, including 100 condos and 300 apartments. Floor plans also include grocery space for much of the street-level retail, and rooftop terraces are advertised for floors 9, 11, and 19. The property is owned by the Acquisition Group, which is partnering with local developer East West Partners on the project. The 20-story towers are all labeled mixed use, with one labeled as a condo building, another as an apartment building, and the last a hotel building. The 19-story tower is a mixed-use office building. In the filing, project architect Gensler says the goal is to build a new destination downtown and to attract new office tenants as well as residents, hotel guests, and retail customers. Gensler filed the alternate design earlier this fall, making the case that the elements of the plan that didn't match certain parts of the city code are as good or better than what the code specified. In the case of the McDowell Street project, they applied for two alternates for transparency, that's ground floor windows, and building massing, how tall buildings are required to step back from the street, says Allison Evans, the City of Raleigh urban designer assigned to the plans in an email. If these recent filings are adopted, they will become part of the overall site plan. The Appearance Commission has already recommended them for approval and they were authorized by the planning director. Gensler is designing the site's master plan and first office building. Barnhill and Brassfield Gore will act as general contractors, while Raleigh-based Kimley Horn is the civil engineer. Boston architecture firm Elkus Manfredi will design the residential buildings at the Nexus. The acquisition group bought the property for $22 million in late 2017. And finally, from the real estate page in this week's Triangle Business Journal, under the heading of Downtown Raleigh, comes the article, Proposed Mixed-Use Building to Feature Retail and Condos on Peace Street. Washington, D.C. developer is making its entrance into Raleigh with a mixed-use development plan for downtown, set to feature condominiums and retail space. Lock 7 Development announced plans October 29th for a four-story mixed-use building at 615 West Peace Street with 24 condos and 1,500 square feet of retail space. We're really excited to be bringing more housing options to downtown Raleigh, says David Gorman, a Lock 7 principal. With so many employers choosing to locate in the city, there's a real demand for more condominium units. The Peace Street project will be the first of several projects we have planned in the city. Condos will feature 1, 2, and 3-bedroom layouts of various sizes, and amenities will include a rooftop terrace, private balconies, and parking. Gorman says no retail tenants have been signed yet. It's a really cool space. There's a lot of good visibility, he says. We'd love to get some neighborhoods serving retail like a restaurant and coffee shop, but we haven't gone after anyone yet. The company closed on the 0.36-acre property on October the 29th for $1.65 million. Construction is scheduled to begin next year and finish in 2021. The vacant land is next to a Starbucks and a Mellow Mushroom. Lock 7 has brought on local architecture firm New City Design and Raleigh interior design company Carrie Moore Design. Chappelle Residential will be handling sales. Gorman says the company is also looking at two similar projects at properties in Cameron Village, though Lock 7 has yet to close on those sites. He says the size of these projects makes it easier to fit in areas that are becoming increasingly built out. Next, we turn to the healthcare and education pages for this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Big Number comes the article, Raleigh Pharmaceutical Startup Brings in $17.5 million. Raleigh-based Bryn Pharma has raked in $17.5 million to fund commercialization of a nasal spray that the company thinks could serve as an alternative to the EpiPen. The company brought in $15 million in proceeds from investors and an additional $2.5 million from a corporate collaborator. Co-founder and CEO David Dworczyk says the financing will help the company prepare for nearing approval and commercialization of its lead product, Bryn NDS1C, an epinephrine nasal spray. The company estimates about 49 million patients in the U.S. are at risk for anaphylaxis, a severe allergic reaction that can be life-threatening. The company hopes its product, if approved, will serve as a comparatively simpler, less invasive alternative for patients. What we hear over and over again is they hate needles. It's too big. It's too hard to use. They're intimidated, and it hurts, Dworczyk says. The company, founded in 2016, has been conducting clinical trials and pushing its product through the U.S. Food and Drug Administration process. Earlier this year, it was granted fast-track designation and in October completed dosing in its trial designed to support FDA approval. And under the heading of approval comes the article, How the FDA Just Helped a Raleigh Drug Maker. Approval of a new indication by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration means a bolstered commercial value of a Raleigh drug maker's product. Mertz, a global aesthetics and neurotoxin company headquartered in Germany with its North American headquarters in Raleigh, has received FDA clearance of a 5-year indication for Celfina, the company's treatment for cellulite. The new indication statement improves upon the drug's existing three-year indication, which the company says is a sign of the drug's effectiveness. It also makes it the only FDA-approved cellulite treatment for a five-year indication. Dr. Terry Phillips, Merz's North America's head of global medical affairs, says the indication further validates it as a treatment option for women with cellulite. Patients are always interested in value for the dollars that they're spending in the aesthetic space, and so five-year data would be very reassuring, I would imagine, to most patients who want long-lasting results, she says. Phillips notes that the five-year indication does not mean the drug is not effective beyond the five-year mark. Now we turn to the On Business page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Rapid Growth comes the article, Triangle Listed Among Top Tech Hotspots for Office Rent. The Triangle has found itself on another top 10 list with other large metro areas. A recent report ranked the Raleigh-Durham area as the 10th fastest-growing tech office market in North America over a two-year span. The CBRE report shows the region saw an overall office rent growth rate of 10.6% for the tech industry between the second quarter of 2017 and second quarter of 2019. CBRE's annual Tech 30 report measures the tech industry's impact on office rents and the 30 leading technology markets in the U.S. and Canada. The Triangle was behind Los Angeles with a growth rate of 11.1% and Nashville, Tennessee at 12.2%. Charlotte ranked fourth on the list with a growth rate of just under 14%. San Francisco topped the list with a growth rate of 17.5%, while Portland, Oregon was second at 15.8%. The report shows the average asking rental rate for the Triangle was $28.41 per square foot in the second quarter of 2019. Overall, for the Tech 30 markets, aggregate annual asking rents were approaching $40 in the second quarter. The Triangle's rent growth was up from 8.9% in the prior two-year period. And the report shows the Interstate 40 Research Triangle Park Corridor was among the top 15 submarkets in North America, with office rent growth of 9.5%, putting it at 13th overall. The technology sector is booming throughout the entire Triangle market. We're seeing companies move and expand in both our CBD and suburban office markets, stated Brad Korsmeyer, Executive Vice President with CBRE, Raleigh's Investor Leasing Group. But he noted the market is still relatively inexpensive compared to Austin, Texas, New York, San Francisco, and others. The tech sector's net absorption rate for office space in the Triangle was approaching 6% for the two-year span. Significant leasing deals announced this year include Pendo's plan to move its headquarters to 125,000 square feet of space and a new office tower planned for Hillsborough Street. The move is expected to happen in 2022. When you couple the competitive pricing with our qualified workforce, the Triangle is a highly sought-after location for any company to expand or relocate their employees, Korsmeyer said. The report says the region had nearly 40,000 people employed in high-tech jobs, such as software engineers, in 2018. Now we reach the cover story of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the cover story is entitled Fresh Start for Iconic Location. Nearly 70 years ago, Scottish-born William Muirhead opened Glen Lennox in Chapel Hill, a property that soon became home to celebrities, athletes, and future leaders. But today, the development has begun to show its age. Aspiring residents once packed waiting lists, yearning to inhabit one of the hundreds of squat, single-story apartments lining tree-canopied roads. Those apartments are now decades old and lack modern amenities. And trees planted in the 1950s, once thought to be a reasonable distance from the homes, have grown, with their roots reaching out to disrupt underground pipes and threaten foundations. Like any property over time, they're not just as modern anymore, says Tim Jezusek, Vice President of Development for Grubb Properties, which bought the property in the 1980s. The development features nearly 70 acres of apartments with a string of retail stores on the southern end of the property and a parcel currently under construction featuring a new multi-story apartment building, parking deck, and office complex. A decade ago, Charlotte-based Grubb Properties began working with the town on a redevelopment agreement that would allow the company to restore the property. At first, the going was slow. The community pushed back because it seemed like a lot back then, says Chapel Hill Economic Development Officer Dwight Bassett. Chapel Hill had a long reputation as a community that was skeptical of new commercial development, requiring prospective developers to jump through hoops with no promise of a favorable outcome. Grubb Properties submitted a redevelopment proposal in 2008. The town rejected it. But that same time marked the beginning of the recession, which gutted the town's office market. That left Chapel Hill's tax base largely residential, leading to the town to pivot toward ways to keep and attract new business and development. That set in motion a new proposal for Glen Lennox, calling for $1 billion in redevelopment, which will include up to 1 million square feet of office space, a remastered retail center, updated apartments, and even hotel and renovated green space. Glen Lennox first opened in 1950. Muirhead named it after his wife, Constance Mary Lennox, combined with the Scottish term Glen that refers to lush valleys. Built in the post-World War II boom, the project was ambitious for its time, with plans initially calling for 314 units at the start and a retail component coming online a year or two later. An additional 126 apartments were added in 1953, bringing the total to 440. Glen Lennox would become the home to a number of luminaries, including UNC Chapel Hill football legend Charlie Choo Choo Justice and current men's basketball coach Roy Williams, who's lived there in 1979 as an assistant coach under Dean Smith. In 1955, Robert Leigh Grubb, the future founder of Grubb Properties, moved in. In 1985, Grubb Properties bought it. Glen Lennox property manager Vanessa Blackwood Spinks had begun working at the site the year before. There were not nearly as many apartments in Chapel Hill in the area, she says. There was a wait list. There was nothing available. If someone moved out, you had five or six people waiting in line. They always took the apartment, sight unseen. The trees planted decades ago were becoming the urban forest that stands there today, and the site was cemented as a beloved community in the region. By the 2000s, however, the property was feeling its age, and Grubb Properties began talks with the town in 2008 about upgrading the property. But Chapel Hill was known to be one of the hardest places for commercial developers to work. The community had long been skeptical of big developers coming to change the look and feel of the town, and few developers knew how to get projects off the ground. When Grubb Properties came calling, Chapel Hill was in no mood to build. Negotiations went on for some time, but Grubb shelved its plans that same year. Then the recession set in motion a trend that would come to threaten the town's shrinking tax base and change the way it considered commercial development in Chapel Hill. By 2009, all office space construction had stopped in Chapel Hill, a dry spell that lasted nearly a decade. It was the first time ever we went such a long period of time for new office, the town's Bassett says. Deliveries went from 160,000 square feet of office in 2009 to zero the next year. At the same time, the amount of leasable space in town started rising. Suddenly, Chapel Hill found itself in need of much more commercial space to attract new business interests as the tax base grew increasingly residential. Officials say that trend can lead to shrinking budgets, as homes tend to require more in services than they pay in through taxes. Today, Chapel Hill's tax base is 82% residential. Most housing, depending on where you are, only covers around 75 to 90 cents for a dollar of services. Commercial can provide anywhere from $1.10 to $1.40 of goods and services, Bassett says. It gives you a healthier budget. we have one of the smallest tax bases nationally. We're definitely the smallest in the Triangle region. To remedy this, town officials and staff members began searching for ways to engage the business community and encourage more office and commercial development. Mayor Pam Heminger says she's been working with the town council and staff on this since she was elected in 2015. We've talked about what our goals are, and what we were doing hasn't been working. And we'll have to think a little bit bigger, like doing inventive policies, like building infrastructure, she says. These are big, bold steps for us. The town reached out to UNC and local businesses to discuss ways to keep them in Chapel Hill as they grow and to encourage new businesses to consider leasing space in town. UNC has almost 600 companies start up. We called for every connection we could find, and we asked what we were doing, Heminger says, and we thought it was going to be money. And from there, the conversation evolved. They said, "We didn't know you wanted us to stay. Well, okay. We need to make sure we send that message loud and clear." The town began working with local landlords to adjust their lease terms and durations to better fit area businesses and work with tenants to find new spaces when they outgrew their current digs. They work with UNC and local businesses to lease other types of space, such as retail, to office tenants, including a local tech firm operating out of a former yoga studio. It's working great for them, she says. To attract new construction, however, Chapel Hill would need to do more than that to show that the historically developer-skeptical town is now open for business. We've done incentives for the first time, Heminger says. That was brand new for Chapel Hill. The town set up a system where developers could be granted back a portion of their property tax dollars for a select amount of time, often around 5 years, with the amount dependent on how much office space, jobs, and added tax value they brought to the project. The first incentive went to Wegmans. "It was going to cost a lot more with us," Heminger says. "The road network needed to be fixed, and they were going to need an incentive to come here." She says it took a while to educate the staff and the public on how these complex incentive structures work, with many raising concerns that the town was misusing taxpayer dollars. Heminger says that because these grants are based on the value added to the property and come only after the company pays the taxes on it, that money never would have come to town in the first place. In the midst of all this, Grub Properties continued to discuss Glen Lennox with the town and its residents. In 2014, the company proposed a new development agreement, and this time the town was ready to approve it. "We came to a consensus about what the community would accept, and it ended up being greater than that what the developer was looking for," Bassett says. Additionally, the town voted to approve a $2.2 million grant for the construction of the first phase of the project that began earlier this year, something Heminger and Jesicek say was necessary to getting the project off the ground. The development agreement laid out a 20-year plan for the property, planning for a multi-phase redevelopment process that could total as much as $1 billion. The 196-page document provides guidance and regulations for developers to follow, including setback requirements, wetland preservation regulations, and building height limits, permitted uses, and other guidelines. Unlike a traditional rezoning request or site plan application, the agreement lists no specifics on the exact number of new housing units or commercial space to be added, but rather new space will depend on what the market demands, assuming it's within the guidelines set forth in the development agreement. The development also has little to say about the specifics of each phase or the order in which they're built, and all that's known for sure is the details for the first phase, which began construction earlier this year. Plans for that portion of the property call for an apartment complex wrapped around a parking deck that it will share with an adjacent office building called the Gwendolyn, named for Gwendolyn Harrison, the first African-American woman to attend UNC Chapel Hill. Jesicek says work has been steady and at times tricky, with older properties often coming with unexpected hurdles or the occasional unrecorded infrastructure underground. All the infrastructure was put in back in the day, he says. All the stormwater pipes need to be repaired or updated, or they'll start digging and find something and say, oh, what? And they've done that. They found something off-site and say, we don't even know how this, what's going on? We have no idea how that happened. The first phase will cost around $100 million to complete, Jezusek says, and crews expect to finish construction on the office portion next year. While future phases have yet to be announced, Jezusek says the company is now looking to the southern portion of the property where the retail center is located. Grubb Properties has brought on retail consultants to assess the market and what would work in the space. Once they make their report, the company will decide what's next. We're looking at what we want to do with retail. How much, he says. There's no magic easy answer. How do you make it right? How do you make it adaptable? Plans for the property as a whole could bring as much as 1 million square feet of office space, Jezusek says. Office space, Jezusek says, though it may be somewhere between 650,000 to 850,000, depending on the market. Additional residential units and retail are also included in the plan. While Grubb Properties sorts out the specifics of future phases, the company has reiterated its commitment to effective urban planning while maintaining the mid-century modern themes and design that residents and neighbors have grown to love. Among the modern updates is to redesign the streetscape to allow for greater bicycle and pedestrian friendliness. We're trying to make Glen Lenox the most bicycle-friendly community in the Carolinas, says Jezusek. No one disagrees with that. But doing it is kind of relearning. This is all 1950s, car-oriented technology and road design. To that end, Grubb went to Denmark and hired Copenhagen's, a Danish urban and design firm specializing in bicycle-friendly designs. The new designs will cater to cyclists of all skill levels and will work to make residents more comfortable biking around the property and ultimately around town. If we can connect us to the new neighborhood to the north and then over to University Place, you can see how much easier how it's much easier for folks to bike to work or get errands or to walk, Jezusek says. How do we make it easy for folks not to have a car? Additionally, the company has been working with arborists and lumber experts to ensure the property's forested field doesn't go away. He says that, unfortunately, developers in the 1950s didn't know as much about trees then as they do today. We're doing everything we can to manage this now as an urban forest, Jezusek says. When they built this, they just put in whatever trees they could. They grew fast, which means they're also coming down fast. We know more now. Additionally, all the trees were more or less the same, meaning they have the same life cycle and are due to come down all around the same time. And that means in 10 years, you could lose a lot, Jezusek says. Through all of this, Jezusek says he and other company employees are in frequent communication with residents and neighbors, with question and answer sessions held every quarter and an open door policy for those interested or concerned. Redevelopment is brutal on anybody. It's hard. It's a neighborhood. You're moving homes. Sometimes you're changing elements of lives, Jezusek says. You're not just taking down buildings, you're taking down memories, in effect. The entire senior team is trying to be as thoughtful as possible on this. The redevelopment comes as new development sweeps across the triangle, with developers becoming increasingly comfortable pursuing projects in Chapel Hill. Longtime Glen Lenox landscaper and part-time resident Mark Clark says he understands the need to restore the property, both in light of its aging amenities and as the area continues to grow and develop around it. We've got all this massive growth here, and you're sitting on a 68-acre beautiful piece of real estate here that now is grossly underdeveloped, he says. But when it was developed 70 years ago, wow, are they cutting edge taking a risk doing that? Now you look at it and say, why didn't they do more? And as usual, following the cover story, we follow with the Executive Voice column. This week's Executive Voice belongs to Matthew Kane. Kane leads Precision Biosciences, which went public in March. So here's the Q&A. What went into the decision to go public? Precision Biosciences was a privately held company for just over 13 years. So we gave a great deal of thought to the question of if and when we were going public would make sense. We ultimately decided to raise capital in an initial public offering, not just due to the magnitude of capital that we expect to require in the future, but equally importantly, speed at which we expect to need to access additional funding should our early clinical programs prove to be successful. As a private company, it is likely that we would still have been able to fund our near-term operations, but the time it takes to do so could have meant a delay for the patients that we were trying to help. We're confident that we made the right decision for the company and have been thrilled by the progression thus far of our first potential cancer treatment. So how does being a public company affect the strategy of the company? We found the transition from private to public has been a positive one overall. Because the funding cycle is far shorter, it allows the team to spend far more time focused on the execution of our plan and thinking about those that may need our products rather than on long and often drawn-out capital-raising efforts. Now, Precision's focusing on some leading-edge therapies. What's the payoff and risk of that? The payoff is that we could dramatically improve the quality of life for those who receive our products. The risk is that we don't. That said, today we are highly optimistic that our research and development efforts will ultimately result in a transformational step forward for the life sciences industry. So what motivates you personally? A deep desire to be a part of a team that overcomes some of life's greatest challenges. My dream is that someday our contributions will be referred to in textbooks. And finally, do you have a favorite book or piece of advice to recommend to anyone? I recommend the book Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari to just about anyone. I found it to be a fascinating overview of how and why humans have been able to uniquely advance through history using various societal bonds and communication techniques. Now, a couple of short articles about nonprofit news. One is animal groups get support from a local brewery. Some Triangle nonprofits that support animals got a lift recently when Linwood Brewing Concern and its sister restaurant, Wilson's Eatery, gave them $10,000 each. The checks went to the Wake County SPCA, Cause for Paws, and Second Chance Pet Adoptions. The firm also gave smaller checks to Saving Grace, an adoption center in Wake Forest, and others. Linwood owner Ted Dyer says Wilson's, which named after his family dog, gives back 5% of food sales to animal charities. He says his twin boys motivated him to do this because of their interest in helping animals. Dyer also says $1 of pints sold on Tuesdays goes to various charities. And under the heading of Fundraiser Supports Effort to Teach Children, the annual fundraiser for Read and Feed will be on November the 15th at 7 p.m. at the Marbles Kids Museum in Raleigh. The event, called A Novel Night Gala, will include cocktails and food, as well as silent and live auctions. Read and Feed's mission is to strengthen literary skills among elementary school children who are not reading at grade level and to provide them with meals in a nurturing environment. Read and Feed uses mobile classrooms to provide food and opportunities for children to grow as readers. Read and Feed was founded in Wake County in 2008. And finally, in an effort to help the homeless with a big day, a one-day effort to raise money for a national effort that looks to support the homeless raised $504,000 on October 25th with a national day of giving that included Family Promise of Wake County. Next, we turn to the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the guest column this week is written by Roger Dow. Dow is president and CEO of the D.C.-based U.S. Travel Association, and his column is entitled, Read This Now If You Have Travel Plans in 2020. The freedom to travel is a recognized, constitutionally protected right that's easy to take for granted. But one year from now, an estimated 99 million Americans could suddenly find that they are no longer able to fly, at least until they get a specific type of identification. On October the 1st of 2020, the Transportation Security Administration will no longer accept driver's licenses that do not meet the requirements of the Real ID Act, that's a 2005 law, that set minimum security standards for state-issued identifications. Anyone without a Real ID license or an accepted alternative, like a U.S. passport, will not be permitted to fly. Here's the problem. Millions of Americans do not yet have a real ID, and most Americans have no idea they'll need one in order to board a plane. According to a survey by Longwoods International, a market research consultancy, an estimated 184 million Americans either don't have a real ID or are unsure if they do. Approximately 99 million Americans say they don't have any form of identification that will be accepted starting October 1, 2020. Overall, only 16% of respondents could definitely say they have a real ID. Most Americans, that's 57%, are unaware that starting October the 1st of 2020, they'll need a real ID license or an acceptable alternative to fly. Unless these numbers improve, the disruption to daily life and our economy will be significant. According to the U.S. Travel Association, if real ID were enforced today, an estimated 78,500 passengers would be denied boarding on the first day, causing $40.3 million in economic damage. If the trend continued, more than 500,000 flyers would be turned away during the first week, with an economic price tag of $282 million. If we want to avoid chaos in our airports, it will require all of us, travelers, industry, states, security officials, and Congress, to act. The travel industry is prepared to do its part. The U.S. Travel Association is organizing hotels, car rental companies, cruise lines, airports, and industry groups to launch an aggressive public education campaign about real ID. By sharing information at hotel front desks, through customer loyalty programs, via social media, and more, we'll do whatever we can to make sure more people know about the upcoming deadline and how to prepare. It's also time for you and your family to figure out if you have real IDs, and if not, make plans to get them. The easiest way to tell is to check for a star in the top right corner of your driver's license, which is the best indicator of a real ID. But even that's not perfect. Washington State does not use a star. Millions of Californians and Marylanders received licenses with a star, but were then told they needed to go back to the DMV and provide additional documents. Oregon and Oklahoma won't begin issuing real IDs until 2020. So the best way to know for sure is to check with your DMV or review TSA's list of acceptable real ID alternatives. Realistically, though, we can't solve this problem by trying to get 184 million Americans to visit the DMV by next October. And rushing to get everyone a real ID is like racing to catch up with the past. The world has changed since 2005. But the Real ID Act and its requirements look the same. Programs like TSA PreCheck and Clear now conduct better security vetting than what's required to get a Real ID. Boarding passes are now digitally stored on smartphones, while Real ID licenses are plastic cards stored in wallets. Congress should act to make PreCheck enrollment equivalent to getting Real ID. Permit states to develop online applications and issue digital licenses, and transition identity verification away from plastic cards and blank stares to automated identity recognition and quicker lines. Air travel is simply too important for keeping our country competitive, connected, and thriving, not to take the real ID deadline seriously. Assuming the deadline will be extended is not a viable strategy. Through public education and smart policy changes, America can finally be real ID ready, and if we do it right, we can make travel safer, more secure, and better prepared for future challenges. And this week's editor's notebook is entitled, Woods and Brady Teach Us a Lesson on Work Attitude. When Tiger Woods hoisted a brand new trophy at Japan just a few days ago to equal the all-time winning record in professional golf, not very many were surprised. And the fact that Tom Brady's New England Patriots remain unbeaten halfway through the NFL season is far from unexpected. Why? Because Woods and Brady hate to lose. In their minds, there's no place other than the top. It's number one or bust. How else could one explain playing for more than 20 years and having the same thirst to win after shattering almost every record in their respective sports? Most sports fans know the legendary head coach of the Green Bay Packers, Vince Lombardi, was a master at inspiring his team. One of Lombardi's sayings, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing," comes to mind. As long as Woods and Brady play, they'll continue to set new standards of success. Resting on laurels may come naturally in human behavior, but not to those two guys. Their approach should offer a blueprint to all of us when it comes to tackling our own responsibilities, no matter what business we're in and what role we play in our society. Raleigh and the Triangle area as a whole get showered with accolades about how smart we are, how our area provides the recipe for the companies to grow, and how our communities are one of the best places to live. For the most part, all of that is true. And community leaders and local government officials have worked hard to provide that environment of success. But all of that can be a distant memory if we falter in our decision-making process. Frankly, being a finalist in the Amazon sweepstakes and getting bypassed by Apple last year should not make us feel content. It should anger us. Many have argued that being named a finalist for those two projects opened up several new projects and hundreds of new jobs for our communities because of the positive exposure to the rest of the world. But that hue will soon be gone. In 2020 and beyond, there will be new opportunities and additional challenges. Just a few days ago, Brookings analyzed a Crunchbase database that concluded Raleigh is ranked number 22 among 99 metros in its Startup Complexity Index, which combined metrics of startup diversity and startup ubiquity. In simple terms, Brookings wanted to find out which metros are poised to grow the fastest in the coming years. Because of the community strength and innovation and technological diversity. One would have thought Raleigh would fare better, but it didn't. We've won a lot in the past, but we need to be constantly hungry to win more. Winning is not only about attracting jobs. Winning is an attitude. Coming in second or being a finalist should not satisfy us. Our communities have a good enough story to come in first, almost every time. We just need that Woods and Brady-like attitude from people who are leading us in the journey. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you'll listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Angier. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. So if you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long till next time.